Members, we're going to call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Please take your seats. It looks like we have a quorum today. Today we're going to be hearing two budget presentations. The first is from the Human Rights Department. The second is from Civil Legal Services. Then we'll hear Representative Knorr's House File 741. That bill is related to money bail use for certain offenses limited. So, with that, has anybody had a chance to review the minutes? And if so, can we get a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Johnson.
I make that motion.
Okay. Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes for February 21st, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes for February 21st, 2019 are approved. And it looks like we have our the Department of Human Rights here ready to testify and provide their budget presentation. And members, what I'd like to do is have them present their complete presentation first, and then we'll do questions after they've had a chance to present what they've got for us. All right, with that, you can go ahead and introduce yourself. Welcome.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. So I should first start out by saying I'm really excited to be back here this morning. I'm also a little bit sick, so I apologize for starting out that way. Let me go ahead and first introduce Scott.
I am Scott Butel, Public Policy Director with Minnesota Department of Human Rights.
You also have a packet in front of you, and you'll find in that packet letters of support from the Diversity Council in Rochester.
Can I just interrupt you for just a second? Would you go ahead and introduce yourself to us again one more time?
Of course. Yeah. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I am the Commissioner for the Department of Human Rights.
Wonderful. Thank
yes.
you. Continue.
Thank you. So you should have in front of you a packet, and you'll find in that packet letters of support from the Diversity Council in Rochester, Unite Cloud, St. Cloud Area Regional Human Rights Commission, as well as a one-pager summarizing the Department of Human Rights budget proposal. Now, the goal of the Department of Human Rights is to build a strong and thriving Minnesota by ensuring that all people can be successful and free from discrimination. The department does this work every day by addressing specific cases of discrimination, addressing systemic disparities, providing education, and engaging in civic engagement. So we really are here for everyone. So let me start by telling you about HELSA. So we're here for the growing aging population. So HELSA is a 53-year-old teacher. She came to us under concerns that older teachers were treated substantially different than younger teachers. We did an investigation and found that to be true. So we worked with the school to resolve this for HELSA and future teachers. So we're here for everyone. We're here for the disabled community. And of course, this is an issue on its own. And like all issues, it's an intersectional issue. This makes sense. We see lots of cross-filings between age and disability. Disabilities become more common with age, with about a third of older Minnesotans having some sort of disability. So let me tell you about Henrik. You may remember me mentioning this story before, but I think it's a powerful story. And Henrik lost his leg in an amputation due to diabetes. He had worked for 20 years at a sitting desk job in IT position. When he returned from medical leave, he was told that he was now going to have to climb ladders and crawl in tight spaces, something he'd never been asked to do before. He requested an accommodation. He was met with hostility and told to resign or quit. We were able to be there for Henrik and negotiated a settlement with the employer that led to policy changes, training, and a monetary settlement for him. We are here for recent immigrants, indigenous community members, and people of color. Let me tell you about Warren. Warren worked at a place where he was subjected to racial slurs. He's a biracial man, and over again, managers used the N-word and referred to him in all sorts of, using a bunch of racial terms like that. So we worked to resolve this matter through conciliation, and the employer is now required to provide trainings to the managers as well as pay damages to Warren. We're here for employers. J.E. Dunn wanted to diversify their workforce for the Minnesota State Capitol Restoration Project right here on Capitol grounds. With our partnership, we helped build out and explain and explore options. And as a result, they were able to exceed the workforce participation goals with 35% of labor hours completed by people of color and 21% by women. This project represented the highest workforce participation levels for women for a construction project in Minnesota ever. We're here for all 87 counties. Each one of these people that we've talked about right now could be you, could be your neighbor. They are your community members. They are your friends, and we're here for them. Our agency also specifically tackles areas where we know there are high rates of disparities through trainings and outreach. For Minnesota, that specifically means racial disparities. Across Minnesota, our state has some of the greatest racial disparities in the nation, and that's across the board, and we've talked about that before. Education, employment, housing, wealth, etc. So Minnesota is becoming more racially diverse every day. All race groups have grown in Minnesota, but between 2010 and 2015, the state added four times as people of color as it did white residents. And right now in schools today, 33% of children across Minnesota are students of color. And so they're changing racial demographics. So we need to confront these disparities. It's critical to the sustainability of Minnesota's economy, and it's also critical to building a strong future for our children. So we're here to talk today about a transformational path forward. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's budget is a transformational investment in building a one Minnesota where communities can thrive in every part of the state. The governor's proposed investment in this agency takes meaningful action to build deeper relationships. That's really core. Build deeper relationships to address these systemic discrimination issues with a real comprehensive approach throughout the state. Before we dive into the proposed budget, let's look at some numbers right now. The department's budget in FY18 was $4.4 million and $4.6 million for FY19. We are primarily funded from the general fund with a small amount of federal funding from some partnership work with the EEOC and a really small grant. Over 90% of our budget is spent on compensation, rent, and IT costs. We are a really people-powered agency. The department's base budget in both FY20 and FY21 is $4.6 million. This number on its own is insufficient. It's insufficient to proactively address the discrimination issues that the state is facing with this growing aging population, with this changing demographics across the state. So the governor's budget is a needed investment to make real progress in what Minnesota actually needs from the Human Rights Department. So let's talk about the governor's transformational budget for the Department of Human Rights. It will deepen the department's work in three essential areas. First, and in the biggest way, it expands the department's capacity statewide through regional offices. Second, it maintains and enhances the department's civic engagement work. And third, increases housing and employment opportunities for community members with criminal records. So let's start with the first one, the regional offices. So all Minnesotans should have access to the Department of Human Rights work regardless of where they live. That's why the governor's proposed budget would allow the Department of Human Rights to open new regional offices in Bemidji, Duluth, Rochester, and Worthington. The offices are essential to carrying out the work because community members have asked us to be there. They want us there. It ensures that the department has consistent statewide reach, especially where greater Minnesota is becoming increasingly diverse and increasingly older. Regional offices help the department build strong and lasting relationships. We know that these relationships are invaluable because in-person conversations and interactions are the most helpful to build the trust that you need to provide the assistance that our community members across Minnesota are looking for. We have an office in St. Cloud, and we've talked about how important this partnership and office in St. Cloud is before. One, we have an investigative officer on the ground there that's able to take charges from somebody face-to-face, and that has helped to build trust there. Two, we noticed that there was an increase in charges being filed for landlords-tenant disputes of discrimination. And so, three, we were able to take that information and do some training with landlords to help prevent discrimination from even happening in the first place. So you can see how valuable those relationships and trusting partnerships are in our regional offices already. Next, I want to talk about civic engagement. As you've heard Scott say several times, the best kind of discrimination is the kind that never happens. So we have a core role to play in preventing discrimination in our civic engagement work. And the governor's budget invests in expanding this work by funding to conduct outreach and build meaningful engagement with indigenous communities, people of color, people with disabilities, recent immigrants, and others. So take this example that I just talked about in St. Cloud, for instance. where instead of just doing a training, we could convene conversations between landlords and tenants, where we could pull together legal aid and other key stakeholders to work towards meaningful changes together. So what more could we do to actually prevent discrimination from ever happening, especially in this time of great housing shortage across the state? So this proposal also, I'll just mention, creates a micro-grant program to support local entities in preventing discrimination where communities have their own local human rights committees. Excuse me. Lastly, the third area is an increase for housing and employment opportunities for community members with criminal records. You know, One Minnesota is a place where everyone has a safe place to live and where there's equal opportunity to employment. As we know, there's a big housing shortage across the board, and that's particularly true for individuals re-entering the community after they served their time to find housing and stable employment. That's why the governor's proposed budget invests in the Department of Human Rights to convene and partner with landlords and to work to really create solutions to these challenging issues. We really are the right agency to convene and have these conversations because of our work around Ban the Box for private employers. We've done the work. We've built the relationships. We've seen the technical needs and assistance that is needed by employers. And so we know it's possible with collaborative work. Moving forward, I'd like to talk about maintaining operations at current levels. So for the operating adjustment, the governor's proposal recognizing the rising salary, rent, and IT costs that are needed to maintain current services for Minnesotans. So the operating adjustment at current levels is $182,000 in FY20 and $379,000 in FY21. Just a reminder, our cost drivers are really staff and rent and IT costs, so we're really people-driven. So those are our main cost drivers there. On-base updates, I think you folks are hearing a lot about different technical updates. We use On-base as the primary workflow and data software system. Every day we work with private and sensitive information from employers and employees, and On-base is essential to our work. We want to make sure that the systems are up to date and operating at the current level, and to do so, that's $75,000 for both FY20 and FY21. So kind of just to wrap up, as we talked about earlier, Minnesota really is facing a paradox. We are a Minnesota where economic and educational leaders are doing some really phenomenal work, but we also are leading in racial disparities in some areas and disability disparities as well. So if we act with intentionality to confront these disparities, and the Minnesota Department of Human Rights can do so, every Minnesotan can make sure that they're on the path to success. We are a small agency fulfilling a big mission. You've heard me talk about our small and mighty team. I really can't say enough about the great work that our 45 employees that are doing to help all Minnesotans with a biennium budget of around $9 million. I think it's important to just note that our current staffing level is 15 full-time employers fewer than it was in the recent past, and substantially almost half of what it was in the 70s. So we are facing more complex issues in an increasingly diverse state and with added duties. And so we appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about the work and the vision of the governor and lieutenant governor for One Minnesota. And I'm excited to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Do we have some questions from members? I think Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here and for your presentation. One of my concerns is the Ban the Box for landlords and the movement towards that. And I am a landlord, and right now we only own duplexes, but there was a time, and it's still important even then, obviously, but when we had multifamily units, our concern when we did background checks, we did these criminal background checks for a reason, and it wasn't just our own back pocket to make sure that these people were going to be able to pay and that sort of thing, but it was so we were looking out for the safety of the other people in that building. And you mentioned that everybody deserved a safe place to live, and I couldn't, you know, that's part of it. As a landlord, is making sure that the people that are going to be living next door to a single mom and her two kids, is a safe person, that they're not a thief, that they're not a felon, that they're not a dangerous person. And so my concern with this whole banning the box and I mean, are we getting to the point where people with a criminal background are now going to be a protected class? I would just like to hear your thoughts on the direction of this whole ban the box for housing.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Scott. I appreciate your question. I think when we're having this conversation, you're hitting on the importance of balancing the needs of public safety with the needs of people who have really served their time and are reentering society and where we know that they will do better, and there's reduced rates of recidivism where there is housing options and where there's employment options. And those conversations and that balance is an important discussion. And I want to be really clear here that we are not talking about any policy language. This is all about convening conversations with landlords, with service providers, and really kind of talk about how do we balance all of this and how do we put this together in a thoughtful way.
Chair Sam?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that response. Because in your conversations, I want you to also consider that if this goes the wrong way, and I as a landlord and many others, and I wish Chair Lesh was here because he's a landlord himself, if this goes the wrong way and that single mom with two young children is harmed by someone that has a previous criminal background check and we're required for some reason to let that person live in the same building and those people are harmed and they want to come back after me as a landlord because I've allowed this person to live there without their knowledge, I want to know if the Department of Human Rights is going to defend me as a landlord. So I would like that to be something that you bring up in your conversations around this subject. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Scott. When it comes to discrimination cases, when it's in employment or in many places, there are protections built into law for instance, in employers right now for these kinds of situations. So this is something that is discussed regularly and is considered in case law all the time. So thank you for your comments.
Chair Constein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really excited to hear about a lot of the collaborations you're doing. That certainly makes things, you're able to do a lot more than you would be with your staff. It's now, what, half of what it used to be. But I kind of look at your department as somebody that is safeguarding the values that everybody around this table espouses. Could you comment on that, please?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Chair Mueller, Representative, I appreciate the question. Yeah, this is a really important conversation about the values that we want as a state. As there are changes in Minnesota, as we're having these conversations, what kind of state do we want to be is the question. We have this opportunity to decide that we're going to make sure that everyone can be successful. We know there is a problem. We can either continue to ignore these problems or and then be complacent with them, or we can dive in and do the hard work. I am excited about this opportunity. And I know a lot of the work that everyone is doing around this table is interconnected and intersectional with the work that we do in our department. It all fits together to make sure that Minnesota is thriving. And if we aren't doing the work to prevent discrimination, then the great work going on in other agencies or with the bills you're working on won't have the impact that they need. If we are investing heavily in education or in housing and we're still seeing huge rates of disparities when it comes to racial rates of home ownership with housing, we aren't actually going to solve the problems that we need. So this all works together. And so I'm excited about this opportunity.
Chair Constein.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair, just more of a comment than something for the testifiers to think about when they're going through this. I have a relative that has worked for a number of years in property management with a large complex, multiple large complexes. And one of the issues that they deal with is with the background of the individuals that are renting there. What they've been sued in the past because something happened and it caused the insurance rates to go up. Now, in Minnesota, we're dealing with that issue. I'm on the housing committee as well, trying to find affordable housing, not just homeowners, but also rental units. They're getting very expensive. Mm-hmm. And between taxes and insurance and regulations, it's getting very expensive to even operate any type of housing unit. And to give affordable housing to these individuals. My concern with the removing the background checks, it greatly increases the liability and greatly increases the insurance costs for these owners of these properties to stay in business and keeping the housing affordable. That's an issue that when you're looking at this issue as removing it, how much is that going to increase the cost of housing for the because right now housing is getting to a point, even rental units, that it's getting very difficult to even people to find houses. We got to be careful so we don't shut the door on rental units because those are a very important part of our housing system.
Thanks, and before you answer that, I just would note that we aren't really talking about removing background checks at this point. I don't know if, Commissioner, you had a response to that comment.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Johnson, I really appreciate you calling out the crisis in housing that's evident in every county in Minnesota. It is a housing crisis, a housing shortage everywhere. So thank you for your comments on that. Yes, I agree with you, Chair Mueller. There is no policy language being discussed at this point, and I think that is exactly why making sure that we're taking into account and considering all of these options is important. I do want to stress that we do have some we have worked in this area with Ban the Box for Employers, and in that area for Ban the Box for Employers, employers are allowed to do background checks. The idea of removing background checks was not removed from that. It's just the timeliness of doing it. And so I just want to clarify how Ban the Box for Private Employers works as well.
Representative Chair, Johnson.
Madam Chair, I know you're not, not supporting policy. But just by thinking about it and putting it in these documents, you are discussing policy.
Commissioner, any comment?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative, you know, every single member of our community is valued, and we have to figure out how to support everyone. And when people have done their time and have served their time, what are we doing to make sure that we're reducing recidivism? We know that housing and employment are those. Is it a complicated situation? Absolutely. Are there nuances? Absolutely. But when I travel around Minnesota, I hear from landlords and tenants and people who are hungry to have these complicated conversations because it is such a crisis, because we have to figure it out. Across the board, we are having a lot of conversations about how we're reforming criminal justice. And if we're talking about criminal justice and we're talking about mandatory minimums and we're having these conversations and we are not also having conversations about housing and employment, then we're going to be missing an opportunity and just create further problems. I agree it is very complicated, and that's why we wanted to tackle it in this thoughtful process.
Thank you. Commissioner, I had a question about how the different locations were selected for the regional offices.
Yeah, Chair Mueller, thank you for that question. So we really wanted to make sure what we heard from Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan is there was a real commitment to geographic distribution across the entire state. And I hope that's what you see well reflected here in these offices. And so first and foremost, what you heard me talk about is that communities have asked for us to be present in these locations. We know that we would like to be more places, that there's more communities that would like our partnership. But with our goal of creating geographic distribution where everyone would be able to get to us in a relatively short amount of time, that was really important to us. We have stories of people driving for many, many hours to be able to meet with an investigator here in St. Paul or in St. Cloud. We'd like to end those kind of stories. People are telling stories about being sexually assaulted at work, raped by their landlord. These are really personal stories, and to have to either do them over the phone or have to drive many hours to do so isn't doing a service to our community members. And so it was intentionally done with that goal for geographic distribution.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Yep, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. It's just a comment. Thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. I just want to remind people that in Minnesota, we have the best and the worst in one. In one, we have the best education, employment, housing, and home ownership and wealth In the other hand, we have the worst disparities, and I'm just excited that you guys are expanding your services to rural areas and to service to areas that really need. Thank you.
Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, and actually met yesterday, and I expressed a desire to have an office in Mankato. Your question was rather timely.
Any other questions? All right. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Representative Herr.
Sorry, I was thinking whether I should make this comment or not, but I just wanted to thank the commissioner for the work that they're doing in the Human Rights Department. I wanted to just maybe address and provide a different viewpoint to Representative Johnson across from me here that I know that we often talk about like those who actually own businesses and the impact on them, but I actually have a friend who has a criminal record, and it was because her partner at the time used her to carry drugs, which she wasn't aware of. And she has since had three children who are A students. She is working at a doctorate in her field of studies, and she's a really amazing person who's done amazing things for the community. And yet her criminal record prevents her from getting housing, for getting appointed to positions in which she's a finalist for, Met Council twice. And so I think that I agree with your comment about ensuring that we include all citizens into that process, because it's really important, and I see that your point on three and increasing housing and economic employment opportunities doesn't speak specifically to banning background checks, and I think that it's really good language to use and how we can include people back into the process and knowing that they've paid their debt to society, sometimes even though they shouldn't have had to pay that debt to begin with, and that does have a lasting legacy in them. So I just wanted to say thank you for actually putting that in writing and putting it in a space where it becomes very public. So thank you.
Okay, thanks. Anything else from members? And anything else from you, Commissioner?
Chair Moeller, thank you so much for this opportunity. We'll continue meeting with everyone one-on-one, but if you have any questions, we're always available and appreciate this time.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. Next, we have the Civil Legal Services budget presentation. So if you want to come on up and introduce yourself to the committee again. Oh, so I'm told that there are some technical issues going on with the PowerPoint, but we do all have a copy of that, and hopefully we can get that up for other folks in the audience here. Are there handouts of that too? Okay. All right. So with that, welcome. Looks like we're coming here, getting closer. But we can go ahead and get started. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right. Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you to the whole committee here this morning. Again, my name is Drew Schaefer. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague.
I'm Ann Hefkin. I'm the Executive Director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota. I apologize for missing the last hearing. It's been quite a winter, so I think you're aware we don't need to talk about that anymore. Hoping I get home today. So thank you for having me today. I also like to take a moment to introduce our colleagues as part of our coalition, because as you may recall, Minnesota Legal Services is a coalition. We're a conglomerate of nonprofits that do this work. So there's Floyd Panuski, who is here with us. He is an Oak adjudicator. Next to him, Cody Nelson from Anishinaabe, serving three reservations in northwest Minnesota. Dory Streit from Legal Aid Service of Northeast Minnesota. Jean Lastine of Central Minnesota Legal Services. And then finally, Jesse Nicholson from Southern. Everyone says Smurls. We know Smurls, right? Southern Minnesota.
So thank you, and thank you all for coming. I know how busy your schedules are, so I really appreciate you taking the time to be here today. So thank you so much. You can
enter here. So our map is, we do have some technology. It's very exciting. As you can see, there's a map of Minnesota. And the reason I took a moment to introduce everyone is just to remind the committee that we do serve all 87 counties in Minnesota with civil legal services. We are doing the non-criminal cases for low-income families and individuals, people with disabilities, the elderly, in non-criminal cases to really meet those critical basic needs to keep people safe, to keep people housed, and to deal with those types of issues. Just a quick example of a story. Sometimes You just need a lawyer to step in. There's lots of great services in Minnesota. We do a lot of great things for our vulnerable population. Sometimes you need a lawyer. Recently up in my service area, there was a 16-year-old kid who came into our office, and both of his parents had passed away. One parent had passed away 3 years prior. Parent passed away within the previous 6 months. And this is a 16-year-old kid who wanted to go to school. He'd gone to the school, and the school said, "I'm sorry, you don't have a guardian. You can't go to school." The school social worker tried to do something. Other people had tried to intervene on his behalf. And he called our office, and we're like, this isn't right. Something needs to be done here. And literally all it took was a phone call from a lawyer pointing out the law, he has a right as a homeless student to be into school. And he was in school the next day with a backpack full of new supplies. And it just was one of those moments that made us feel really good about the work we do. We all are doing this work because we love it so much. So we're here today to talk about our budget request. There are three sources of state-administered funding that Civil Legal Aid receives. They're all distributed through the Minnesota Supreme Court's Legal Services Advocacy Committee. The one we're going to obviously focus on today is the general fund appropriation. It's currently $13.72 million. The way the statute works is that 85% of that appropriation goes to the services that you see here, the regional services, to ensure that there is statewide coverage for civil legal aid in every corner of this state, the metro, the rural areas that I serve, and in between. 15% of that state appropriation then goes into a competitive grant process. As you can see on slide four, the state appropriation is a significant part of our funding and a very important part of funding, and we're thankful to the state of Minnesota for providing this funding. But we also use that state appropriation to leverage and to receive funding from other sources, including foundations, United Ways, federal government, and using state appropriation as matching dollars really allows us to do a lot more of the work that we do. And it's, again, it's about $13 million of a total of close to $40 million. So, again, a significant source and a source that really helps us leverage other sources of funding. So what is that you? It does say Drew on my slide. So
I'm going to just summarize briefly what our request is for fiscal years 2020 and 2021. We're asking for an increase of a little over $1.6 million for the next fiscal year, and then an increase of $2.5 million for the fiscal year following that. So a stepped increase over the budget biennium, which would raise investment in civil legal aid from the appropriation that this committee is shepherding to $15.366 million total for fiscal year 2020, up from $13.72 million. And then fiscal year 2021 would take it up to $16.288 million. And we'll talk a little bit about the significance of those numbers later in the presentation. One of the key bases for the requested increase is the need for salary improvement in civil legal services. Civil legal services has a compensation deficit. You have heard from other parts of the justice system about the compensation deficits that they have described compared to other public sector employers that employ attorneys and legal professionals who want to serve the public. We are far behind everybody else in the system. We have some data that we've put together. Our average starting salary is now $48,673, 12% lower than the public defenders. We have a turnover rate that was approaching 30% for the period from September 2017 to September 2018. When we looked at this closely and surveyed legal aid providers across the state of Minnesota and asked them for this information, and we isolated that to that 30% figure, it's actually about 29.6%. We looked at attorney turnover rates in legal aid providers' offices. If you look at more broadly at staff, there's a consistent turnover rate that is similar. And this turnover rate that we have been seeing is higher than other public sector employers have described to you. And really what it comes down to is we have a significant compensation deficit. We start lower than everybody else, and the data shows that year 5, year 10, year 15, we fall further and further behind as people progress in experience and become skilled. And so to own homes, have families, live and enjoy lives, they can't really afford to stay with us. And most of them leave for other public interest and public sector employment. We continue to serve the public. So we are hoping that with this increase, we are going to be able to make substantial investments to increase our compensation of our staff and to reduce this deficit. Now, the level of investment we're talking about with the increase we're requesting is a minimum of close to $1 million in fiscal year 2020 and then $1.5 million the following year. If we are able to make those investments, we will be able to increase our compensation 2 to 6% depending on other costs that we have and what we can anticipate and budget right now. And we're very conservative in our budgeting. So it's not going to make up even close to all the difference, but it will help us move in the right direction to be more competitive and to hopefully improve the efficiency and effectiveness of our operations so we're not, you know, losing staff at the rate that we've seen in recent years.
The second basis for the increase is the increases in health care costs in recent years. And again, I know that you've heard this from other parts of the justice system. Both the PDs, public defenders, and the judicial branch have talked about this. Civil legal aid is not on the state insurance program, but we do face the same challenges with increased costs. And you can see the numbers on the slides. We are continually evaluating our health care coverage. My program, for example, we use a broker, as I think everyone uses a broker, to find competitive bids and ask our staff to change providers every couple of years. So in 3 years in a row, we change plans in order to keep the costs low. That being said, the costs continue to rise dramatically. You can see some examples here. Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota over the past 3 years has had a 33% increase in their health care costs. Mid-Minnesota from 2015 to 2018, a 35% increase. And this is on top of, you know, what we're doing to try and keep these costs low. We all know that this is an issue that we're not going to solve here today. In the past 10 years, Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid has done a whole bunch of things to try and reduce their costs and has saved $1.2 million over that 10-year period. That being said, there's still been a 35-plus percent increase. So the proposed investment would be in FY 2020 would be about $435,000 to offset those health insurance and other benefit increases. And then in 2021, a little bit more, $678. And these are to mitigate the, in the past, when those increases are happening and our revenues haven't increased, we've had to take away from other services and not fill positions and not do the things we wanted to do. So we're hoping to mitigate some of that, the bleeding of the cost into the healthcare area. And finally, I think, and I know Drew mentioned this in the first presentation, is that we're not able to serve everyone who has these critical legal needs in the civil area. We serve about 2 out of 5 eligible people who seek services. By increasing salaries a little, by maintaining decent health coverage for our staff, we're hoping to retain staff longer. Staff that stays, staff that is trained, these high-quality legal services, they're going to provide more client services. So we're hoping to serve a little bit more and maintain what we have. So, and you guys can read that. Historical, just a quick look at our historical legislative funding. Civil legal services is really flat over the last decade. As you can see, in FY 2008-2009, we're at about $13.3 million. Took a hit during the recession years in between 2010-2013. Have started to improve a little bit, but really over the last 10 years, in actual dollars, we've only gone up about a little over 3%, not really covering even cost of living. So we're really flat funding over the last 10 years.
And we thought it was helpful to the committee to look at this from an inflation-adjusted or real dollar perspective. I've seen some of the other justice partners use those metrics to describe the issue. And when you look at the real dollar adjustment, we are actually a $13.3 million funding level in fiscal year 2008 equates to roughly $15.5 million to $16.1 million now. And that's, you know, using conservative rate of inflation calculations and U.S. Consumer Price Index data. So what we are really hoping to do with our request now in increasing to $15.366 million in annual funding in fiscal year 2020 and $16.288 million in fiscal year 2021 is to catch up to where we were in actual real dollars 12 years ago. So we have fallen behind, and that is part of the reason why we've fallen further behind and have this increased compensation deficit, and then we get hit really hard with the unavoidable increases in health care costs that affect our bottom lines. And so that is the basis for this request. Now, Representative Liebling asked me a question a couple weeks ago when I was here giving the Civil Legal Services overview, and this slide is the answer to the question, which is, what would it take to meet 100% of current demand for civil legal aid with our current case priorities, which are, you know, life or death cases for families and ordinary Minnesotans and elder Minnesotans and children across the state, and what it would take to meet current demand over and above our current request would be an additional $63 million and change to do that. And we're not asking for that. Our request is much more modest and measured. But we, to sustain what we are doing now, where we are still forced to turn away 60% of eligible families that come to us for help, we need this requested increase to do that. And just by way of example and analogy, I wanted to show a couple data points that would show how we could affect the unmet need for civil legal aid in Minnesota with modest investments above what we're requesting. So an additional $2 million per year above what we're requesting would help meet 1/20th of that existing need and demand for civil legal aid currently, which would take us from serving 40% of eligible families to serving 43% of eligible families. If we wanted to get to 50%, it would take about $10.5 million additionally. So I put this information together just to show, in response to that question, which I thought was an interesting way of looking at the issue of, we have this demand, you know, what would it take to meet certain points of reference of the demand, and that's the calculation. So lastly, I'll just turn it over to Ann. This is our last slide, and then we'll entertain questions.
Yeah, just this is a study that was done with an economist a couple of years ago. I think that it still holds true. We believe, and research backs it up, and this has been done in a number of states, to show the return on investment for civil legal aid is significant. For every dollar invested, close to $4 is returned to the state. So in addition to just keeping people safe, we think we are a good use the state dollars efficiently. And we really just appreciate the committee's time today. So we're open for questions.
Okay, great. I think Chair Considine first.
Well, thank you, Chair Mueller. Back one slide. Nope, that's not the right one. The one about if you got $2 million, you could go to 50%. What does that equate to in families? Roughly, ballpark.
Oh, go ahead, Mr. Schaefer.
I don't like percentages when we're talking about people.
So right now we serve about 45,000-46,000 families.
At 40%. So yep, we're looking at 10,000 more people that we could be serving.
10,000 more households.
Households that are in desperate need of services.
Yes.
Go ahead, Chair.
Thank you. And then last year, I think it actually ended up getting killed, but Representative Cresha had a bill where to help farm families, they were going to change how they assessed property for your, to qualify for you. What are we talking about then as far as numbers of more people, farm families coming in? Do you have any idea?
I don't have I'm not familiar with the particular bill. I don't have the number, but to your point, you know, when there are considerations made in public policy making and legislation about creating pathways to get to us.
Correct. Yes.
It is hard for us to meet that new flow of demand because it increases a demand that we're already
not meeting. So it would likely affect, without additional resources, our ability to meet whatever additional need there would be.
And as I recall, Chair, there was no additional resources attached to the bill. And last, I'm just disappointed you didn't bring Chuck Thomas with you.
Apologize.
We love Chuck Thomas. Thanks, Chair Mullen.
Yep. Let's see. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question for either testifier. So in that reference you just cited, for every $1, you get a $3.94 return. I'm just wondering if you can expand on that. That's, you know, nearly a 300% increase. So how does that economic growth, how is that produced?
Go ahead. You got it?
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Lucero. What we look at is we look at the financial impact of the work we do. So we all use different case management systems, and when we complete a representation of a family, we look at the dollar value that we acquired or protected for that family. And the numbers are extremely impressive. For example, I just looked at one program in one of my greater Minnesota offices in St. Cloud. We do a lot of healthcare outreach work to help people access healthcare, families in need. And we looked at our 2018 numbers, and we helped them access $14 million just with this one program in a greater Minnesota office in value in healthcare benefits that they otherwise would not have had access to. And similarly, in any case, we do a lot of work to protect and to stabilize and to keep families safe and stable in their financial situations, their public benefits, and their health care. We look at that, we measure it, and frankly, the $3.94 figure for return on investment was a few years ago and done by an economist here, but there have been other studies done around the country in particular types of cases that we do as a matter of course that have shown a much higher return on investment. There was recently a study in Philadelphia about preventing illegal evictions that showed a $15 return on investment. Some white shoe accounting firm from New York City delved into all the metrics for public cost savings of the type of work we do. There's been a lot of research like that done in other parts of the country that we've looked at, and the data consistently shows a return of investment on, you know, $4, $5, $6 in every public dollar invested in civil legal aid.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. And then when you mentioned additional dollars secure, are those federal grants, or where are those additional dollars coming from?
Mr. Schaefer.
Chair Mueller, can you repeat the question?
I thought I heard you say, maybe I misunderstood, when these dollars are spent or allocated on the state level, you can obtain additional funds from other sources, grants, et cetera, and I'm just wondering what the source of those additional dollars are, if I heard you correctly.
Yeah, sure. Yes, Representative Chair. Thank you. Sometimes a grant, like a foundation or federal dollars, will require matching funds. So, for example, some of the work that my organization does for seniors, and seniors is broadly defined as anyone over 60, through Title III dollars through the federal government, they require a matching grant. So for that $50,000 that we receive from the federal government, we must match it with $50,000. So that's one example from my program where the state appropriation is used to really double the dollars and double the amount of work we can do, in this case for seniors in Northwest Minnesota. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Let's see. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I found the presentation very interesting. And thank you for following up with that big number about what it would actually take to meet the need. You know, I think this is really important stuff, because we may all have the same rights, but if you don't understand your rights and can't vindicate them, it's like not having them. And I think that's where your agency is really important. But one of the I don't know if I heard in your presentation how many attorneys you have and maybe how many, just to general, how many support people and stuff. I'm going to ask you for that. But here's what I really kind of wanted to understand a little more. You presented this information about your health care costs, and I think you said you have to go to a broker. And I'm wondering, you know, why your agency can't be in the state health care pool, why maybe you're not, I don't know what your status is as an agency, maybe you're just quasi-state agency, why you can't be in CGIP and, you know, take advantage of the larger pool. So that's one thing. And then, so maybe you could answer that, and then I just have a brief comment, Madam Chair.
Go ahead. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair. We're not a state agency, so that would be my answer to that. I don't exactly know what the history is there. We are independent nonprofit organizations. I do know that there is one state, Kentucky, in fact, strangely, that does have their independent legal aid organizations on their state health insurance. Most states do not. I think it's something we'd certainly be open to investigating, and I guess I can't answer that question other than we are not a state agency. We receive a state appropriation.
And the numbers of people.
Do you know that? I don't have that in my head. Drew has a lot more numbers in his head.
Chair Mueller, Representative Leland, what was the other question?
The numbers of attorneys.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. We have 260 attorneys statewide that provide civil legal services in LSAC grantees. And then, you know, as far as the additional staffing, I don't have those numbers exactly off the top of my head, but I believe it's I'm not going to speculate on it, so I can get you that information after I talk to my colleagues and compile it. But 260 attorneys doing the work, we looked at that.
And then, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. And so I guess I just wanted to kind of make a comment. It's really pretty distressing that your salaries are so low compared to other comparable attorneys. And I assume the staff, it's the same. You didn't talk about your staff. You know, I assume you have paralegals and other folks. But probably it's not something we can do much about this year. But, boy, I'd like to see us have some kind of level playing field. It just occurs to me that, you know, we've got attorneys providing civil legal services. We've got public defenders. We have prosecutors in different county attorney's offices, we have the AG's office, and the salaries just seem to be all over the place. And I don't know, it seems like people are kind of at comparable education level, doing a lot of the same kinds of work, although perhaps on a different side or from a different angle. But it just really strikes me as very wrong that people who are doing the important work that your agency is doing have such low salary levels. And you know, it's one thing to just appropriate some money to help bring those up. I sure hope that the chair can do that in his bill. But I'd like to see us kind of relook at this whole thing a little bit more across the board. You know, and in my experience, it's really good for attorneys to have the experience of going, you know, being a prosecutor, then being a defender, then doing civil legal, you know, kind of having in your career the opportunity to be on different sides and do different kinds of work all. And it would be great if people could do that in the public space without, you know, having these big cliffs in terms of salaries. And the idea that we're having 30% turnover, that is costly. I mean, we know from every employer that we talk to that getting new people, having high turnover is very costly in itself. And I know the kind of work you do requires experience and training. I couldn't walk into the office and start doing that work without some real help. So we got to cut that turnover and just because we're just wasting money by having high turnover. And I don't know if you've I didn't hear any quantification of that. I know many employers will tell you it costs me X amount to retrain a new employee, or I spend X amount on training every year. But maybe that's something we ought to know as well, because that's a cost, too, that we are paying for when we appropriate money to your agency, too. So I guess I'm rambling a little bit there, Madam Chair, but I'm very struck by this, how really out of whack it all is with the rest of the system, and how really that is not doing us a service. So
yeah,
thank you.
Before you comment on that, too, I would just notice when I looked at your starting salary and thinking about how many people I know that are still paying their law school loans off, and the college and law school loan burden on top of that would make this starting salary very difficult for many people to choose. I'm seeing your staff nodding their head in agreement in the background. But if you wanted to comment on Chair Liebling's statement, feel free.
Chair Mueller, thank you. And Representative Liebling, thank you for your comments. You know, I can speak from experience at my office. In this period where we looked at turnover, I lost 15 practicing attorney positions in this 13-month period that we looked at. 14 of them went to other public sector employment, state agency jobs, other justice-focused nonprofits, the public defender, county attorney offices. People wanted to serve the public. They wanted to continue to do public service, and they could do it in a more competitive compensation environment. And, you know, so, and your point about measuring the cost of it, I mean, I can tell you every time we hire an attorney, we have a hiring committee with several people on it that have to spend time reviewing and interviewing applications and applicants, and then going through these processes of training, and then sometimes there's gaps before a position is filled. It really does hit productivity and hit the efficiency and effectiveness of our operations in a way where, when it's a constant churn like it's been in recent years, it affects us. It affects morale. It affects our ability to do what we do, which we do very well, but it affects it, because when you lose that many people that are skilled at what they do and know how to do these cases quickly and efficiently and help a large number of people in doing really critical work, it is hard to do. And there is a huge cost. I mean, it's a huge cost it's very hard to quantify, because a lot of it is the time of staff and that goes into recruitment and training and so on and so forth, but it is significant.
All right, and I think Chair Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I notice that the starting salary is $48,673. If you receive the ask that you've presented here today, what do you anticipate the starting salary to move up to?
Go ahead.
Chair Mueller, Representative Scott, our hope would be to increase 2 to 6%. We ideally would like the statewide average for starting salary to be over 50, because at least that's a symbolic number, right, that has some significance, I think, to young legal professionals who are looking for employment. But as I mentioned on the slide, we have a significant compensation deficit up the salary schedules that we have, where we will need more robust investment to really make a difference up the scale. But at least for starters, our goal would be to get the statewide average to over 50 and to get closer. The public defender started $55,115 to get closer to that number. We're 12% lower now. We want to get closer to that number.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. A question: because of this salary range for folks, are they qualifying for subsidy help or premium assistance help with their health insurance?
Go ahead. Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We provide health. All of our programs have health insurance, so they're not on the market generally. They may, frankly. They do. Which I thought where your question was going, is that there are a few programs that help with the student loan burden. So some of that helps a little. That said, you know, people are coming out of law school now with over $100,000 of debt on average, which kind of makes me, gives me a little bit of a moment to have an anxiety attack. So they're not on the public market for health insurance generally. So, okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's it. Thank you so much for your presentation. We really appreciate it. And we do have a bill that needs to be heard right now, a Representative Knorr's bill, House File 741.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. We have to shuffle our papers here. All right, Representative Knorr. So it looks like we have House File 741. Would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to introduce the two amendments so that we can have the bill in the shape that I want.
I think we need to move the bill first, and then we'll do the amendments after that, if that's correct. So, and it's my understanding that you will be moving your bill to be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Now, Representative Knorr, if you wanted to talk about your amendments, let's talk about A5 first. Does everybody have A5? I think I hear all the papers shuffling. Okay.
All right. Is there any discussion about the A5 amendment? All right. Hearing none, those in favor of adopting author's amendment A5, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now let's go to A6. Is there any discussion on A6? All right. Hearing none, those in favor of adopting author's amendment A6, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So now, Representative Knorr, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 741. This requires courts to release individuals who are charged with misdemeanor offenses other than DWI, domestic assault, domestic abuse, DANCO, you know, assault on fifth degree, stalking, harassment, restraining order. This bill releases individuals on their own recognizance. This bill eliminates something which I call criminalizing poverty. You've heard from the previous speakers when they talked about the disparities that exist, the injustice that exists in our system. So this bill creates an opportunity to allow someone who has been charged with misdemeanor, if they cannot afford to pay the bail, to be released on their own recognizance. Madam Chair and members, I've seen this play in many courtrooms where someone who has not been charged of the offense is lingering in a jail because they cannot afford to pay $78 or even $35. This creates a problem that we have had in many times. It creates a significant barriers for someone who cannot afford to lose their job, hence their employment, to lose their housing because they can no longer pay the rent, or even to lose the custody of their children. And some will be deported because they've been put through the system. Madam Chair, this is something that I consider we need to have a change in our justice system. This forces people to think twice. If I have resources and money, I can walk out of that jail no matter what. But if I'm poor, if I'm a person of color, or a low-income individual, I will not be treated the same as someone who has the money. Money should not be a factor in deciding whether someone should sit in jail or should be in the community. We should allow justice system to work for all, and not just for few individuals who will take that advantage. I want to make sure that we create equity in our system. And with that, we want those innocent individuals not to plead guilty just to walk out of jail because they cannot afford to pay that money. If we want to address the criminal justice process, it starts from the time that a person is arrested. We have many folks who are here to testify on this bill. Madam Chair, if you will allow me, I wanted to welcome the City Attorney, Ms. Siegel, to discuss about this bill.
Yes, go right ahead. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Susan Siegel. I'm the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis. And we in the city attorney's office in Ramsey and Hennepin County, city attorneys prosecute all adult offenses punishable by up to a year in jail. Rest of the counties, it's the county attorneys that have full jurisdiction for everything. In 2018, we handled about 14,000 cases in our office. We hold public safety as our watchword, as well as doing justice. So we are very supportive of Representative Knorr's bill as amended. It does exclude all domestic misdemeanors. It excludes domestic no-contact orders, orders for protection, harassment restraining orders, DWIs, the really victim public safety oriented misdemeanor level offenses. And so with those changes, we are very supportive. We've done a lot of work in our office and in Hennepin County already with risk assessment tools and others so that people now on these lower-level types of offenses generally are released. from jail. The only ones that are kept in are ones, and you have to be pretty chronic before a Hennepin County District Court judge will hold you in, but are chronic failures to appear. And that does happen. We just recently had a case where it was continued six times for six failures to appear for a pretrial. So that is one thing that I think, particularly since this is the financial division, is, and I see the state public defender is sitting right in back of me, is along with these important policy changes would be considering increasing funding for the public defender's office in the busiest offices, you know, wherever that's needed. Hennepin County is certainly one of those, as well as judicial resources, so that we can handle these cases more quickly, so that there's accountability in the system, and we can deal with some of these chronic failure to appear situations. As we're looking, this is one piece in the bail reform puzzle, and I have been leading an effort. We're going to be holding a forum in early summer to look towards a more holistic bail reform approach. We have several states around the country now with experience. We want to bring in some national experts, learn from mistakes and things that have gone well in other states, so that we can make our system more just, create a better system that's a Minnesota system, and we will invite legislators to that as well. If you have any questions, I am happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Siegel. And so I had intended to have all the testifiers first. I saw Lucero, Representative Lucero had a question. Is it specific to this testifier? Go right ahead, then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask the testifier, because I saw you at the previous committee hearing, public safety, and you had left by the evening session, so we weren't able to ask you a question. And the question is, there's a list in the bill of exclusions which would not apply in somebody being released, and among those is not, for example, fifth-degree arson. And I'm just wondering, in your experience, do you believe that somebody who commits fifth-degree arson and being released would pose a safety threat to the public?
Go ahead, Ms. Hill.
Yeah, I think fifth-degree arson could be considered. That would be a public safety risk, and maybe as a potential amendment. That hadn't occurred to us, quite honestly, and I can look into it and work with the representative on that question if we feel looking at our cases like that is something that should be considered.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. And then to the bill author, then, I did mention this in the previous committee, and that is just one of a whole list of misdemeanors that are not part of your exclusion list. And since you did hear that, I'm wondering then why, by this committee, you had not created an amendment, for example, that crime or others that pose a safety threat.
Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, I think if you look at the bill, if there's any public threat, even to the victims, as we just amended, the judge will have to take that into consideration. And we haven't excluded everything that needs to be excluded, but this, you know, when it comes to the safety of the victims of domestic abuse and domestic assault, we need to take that serious. And that's why it's included in here, working with the advocates to make sure that we protect the victims of domestic assault. It's not going to include everything in this bill, but if you look and read carefully, the judge has got the leverage of looking into if this is going to create a public safety issue or safety for the victims.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just finish with this. I have read the bill, and I've read it carefully, and I believe, as the testifier agrees, that fifth-degree arson is one of those that does pose a threat, and that's one of the reasons why I oppose this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson, is your question specific to the testifier here, or is it more general?
This is specific to this testifier.
Go right ahead, then.
We have talked a little bit in the public safety hearing as well. It's my understanding, I've been in court many times, been in a number of bail hearings. And if this has changed in the last 6.5 years since I've been in law enforcement, please let me know. Generally, when somebody's in jail and goes up for their first appearance to set bail, Sometimes the public defender is there representing them. But as a prosecutor, you're representing the people. And they have the hearing, public defender, or whoever their attorney is, requests one type of bail, usually RPR, release on personal recognizance. But isn't it true that it's the prosecutor who requests the judge on the bail amount? You talked earlier in the previous committee how somebody had a $35 bail. Wouldn't that be the prosecutor requesting a judge to set bail at a certain level? And the judge might reduce it or go above it or do the recommendation of the prosecutor?
Ms. Siegel.
Madam Chair and Representative, the prosecutor does request bail as a practical matter in a large county like Hennepin. People are able to be released pre that first hearing. If you're in on a Friday, for example, you're going to sit there until Monday. Hennepin does work earlier. There is an automatic bail schedule. It's also important that there be some uniformity and not left so that there's such a wide disparity. We do in Minneapolis, we approach things in a certain way, but that can be very different if you've got a prosecutor from St. Louis Park or a prosecutor from Golden Valley or Richfield, I mean the surrounding communities. So I think there's value in uniformity. I can tell you in Minneapolis, with the changes with this automatic release for people who score, you know, low to medium risk on this risk assessment factor, the city has not fallen apart. So I don't think, and I would not advocate for something that I felt risked public safety. I think this is an important issue for our criminal justice system. There are many, many collateral consequences that come with being in jail, missing work, losing your job for something that is really a low-level misdemeanor. So I think this whole area is something that needs attention. We have a lot of really good research now to help guide us. The $78 automatic bail schedule in Hennepin County, it's $75 to pay for the court surcharge and $3 for the Hennepin law library fee. So is that how bail should be set and decide whether one person spends, you know, 3 or 4 days in jail and somebody else who has $78 does not? I don't think that protects public safety. And in fact, it could make it worse, because if people lose their employment, if they have all of these collateral consequences, they are not on a good path for the future. And we are learning, and research backs us up, that the more we address the underlying needs, I mean, in a big city like Minneapolis, we've got substance abuse. We've got all sorts of other issues that people have who have otherwise fallen through the cracks. And if we don't address those issues and provide the services and address their underlying needs, then public safety really is at risk.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, unless something's changed, you mentioned if they get picked up on a Friday night, they sit till Monday. I hope Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis is not doing that, because a bail hearing would have been required to telephonically with the judge on Sunday. That was required, been done for years ago. Also, you talked about that $75. If Hennepin County has that automatic bail schedule, I did some checking, and what you're proposing is already being done by the court system. March of 2018, they got rid of the bail schedule. If you're doing a bail schedule now, you're in violation of the judicial's mandate. So that makes me really wonder what's going on in that county.
Ms. Siegel.
There is weekend bail review. People, before they're actually in court, though, is the following Monday, and they can be held over the weekend. And as to the bail schedule, I can assure you that Hennepin County District Court is fully complying with all statutory and constitutional requirements.
Okay, and I would like, I know we have some other questions, but in the interest of time, let's go ahead and hear from the other testifiers. And Ms. Siegel, if you wouldn't mind sticking around for the rest of the committee hearing.
No, I'd be thank you. Thank you all.
Yep. All right, Mr. Ward, come on forward and please reintroduce yourself to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is William Ward. I'm the State Public Defender from Minnesota. I've decided to go to a Plan B to address some of these questions. As a reminder to all of you, I represent, or my office represents, individuals who are accused of crimes in all 87 counties. Let me read you 601. This is current procedure, current law, for all misdemeanors in Minnesota. Mandatory citation issuance in misdemeanor cases. By the arresting officer, in misdemeanor cases, peace officers who decide to proceed with a prosecution and who act without a warrant must issue a citation and release the defendant unless it reasonably appears needs to be detained to prevent great bodily harm to that person or another, further criminal conduct will occur, or substantial likelihood exists that the person will not respond to a citation. That's current law, no matter the misdemeanor, fourth degree or whatever, no matter the misdemeanor, current law. This bill deals with 602, right? If they are not released and they are then brought to court, whether they're held over for the weekend, whether telephonically the court chooses to keep the bail set at what it is, on the, you know, and they stay in custody. And what this bill is addressing are the areas where we are failing miserably in Minnesota, and that is setting bail that people cannot afford. I said this before. I bet you just about everybody in this room, if you had to come up with $400, $200, $78 for a family member or a friend with your access to cash, debit, or credit, you would do that, and you could do that. My clients can't do that, so they stay in custody. That is when Representative Knorr talks about criminalization of poverty. It is the poor people who are staying in custody. What this bill does, if it gives teeth to, statutorily, where the courts are not following the rules. We are presumed innocent in this state, folks. That's the Constitution. So when you say they present a substantial risk because of the charge, they are presumed innocent. And bail needs to be set accordingly. So bail should be set and must be set based upon the financial considerations of the individual. If you set bail at an amount that they cannot make because they are poor, that is against the Eighth Amendment. It's excessive bail. It is prohibitive. So what Representative Knorr is trying to do with this bill is address those situations on nonviolent misdemeanor cases. Right? Loitering. Domestic conduct, disorderly conduct. Spitting, you know, smoking in the lounge, whatever that is. That's what this is addressing. And if you think for a minute that the courts are doing so, you are seriously mistaken. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation. 95% of the population increase in jails in this country, 95% of it is due to people who are being held in custody pre-trial when they are presumed innocent. So bail is being set excessively to these people. When you think in terms of how many cases are dismissed in the system and people are in custody, when you think in terms of how many people we litigate their cases on and we are successful, they are sitting in custody. When you think of people who are in custody for $300 or $400 and they lose their jobs, they lose their housing, they lose their family members, CHIPS cases are filed against them for $400. That's what this is addressing. It's not about scary people getting out. It's not about the vicious. It's not about being mean and evil. It's about common sense. And stop housing people for $135 a day on a nonviolent misdemeanor case. That's what this is about. I don't, you know, I could talk about this over and over. But when you hear things about it works well in my office, it works well in my county, it works, it doesn't work that well. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here. It doesn't work well. It's the rules are not being followed. So I'm urging you, as representatives of the state, to put some teeth in a bill so the rules could then be followed better and get these people out. Representative Knorr talks about people who plead guilty to crimes get out of jail. You know how heartbreaking that is? You have no idea. I represent people who plead guilty so they can get out. And mind you, I know people are thinking, well, they did something anyway. That's the wrong thought. Get them out so they can be properly represented. So they'll make decisions because they're sick and tired of being confined. Anybody been here and been in a jail? I have. Not just in my capacity as a lawyer, but having been arrested. You don't know what it's like. And that's why people plead guilty. Give nonviolent people a chance to keep their lives, to keep their livelihood, to keep their car, to keep their house, and pass this bill. I urge you to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. And I think you have one other testifier. Is that correct, Representative Noor?
Yep, Bill.
Yes. Mr. Feist, welcome. And if you can try to keep your comments very brief so we make sure we have time for questions. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ben Feist, Legislative Director with the ACLU of Minnesota. I will be very brief today. I think we've already heard some great testimony in support of this bill. I simply want to add that the ACLU nationally has been looking at smart justice ways to really improve our systems, and ultimately the goal is to reduce incarceration by 50% across the country. And bail reform is a big piece of that puzzle. So we are very supportive of this effort today. We'd actually like to see it go a lot further than it does. It's a moderate approach to this issue, and hopefully this can get done, and we can continue working on this going forward. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. I think Representative Grassley, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking through the bill, and I see a lot of the court must impose, defendant must be released, court must impose over here again. I guess, you know, some of my legislation I've been asked, you know, how about the separation of powers? Can you tell us how this bill doesn't violate the constitutional separation of powers clause that gives a court the power to set bail?
Representative.
Madam Chen, members, this language is directly from the 602 and 603, and I will defer to Mr. Benson if he can, Johnson, I mean, so that he can provide us more detail what is in the Constitution and how does this bill address that issue.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, briefly, I think Mr. Grassl's question is dealing with separation of powers issues. When it comes to the judiciary, the separation of powers issues fall down on grounds of whether the law is substantive or procedural. In general, the legislature is able to establish substantive laws and requirements related to criminal penalties, for example, setting statutory maximums. Whether or not this is a substantive or a procedural matter is always up to the determination of the court. I will note that the legislature has established many laws related to bail, for example, setting and requiring courts to impose maximum bail in certain cases, and the courts have found those to be something that they enforce, and so they are enforcing those related to bail. I do not know for sure whether they would impose these or not.
Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Noor, for bringing this important bill before our committee. I have a couple questions that any of the testifiers may answer. Madam Chair, would the previous testifier before Mr. Feist please,
Mr. Ward?
Mr. Ward, thank you, please come on up. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Ward, do we currently know how many Minnesotans are sitting in Minnesota jails for nonviolent misdemeanors?
Mr. Ward.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the actual number. We could certainly, every day you could do a count and for all 87 counties to see who's there and what their bail amounts are set at.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you so much for that answer. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ward, for that answer. So even though we don't have an exact number, is it fairly accurate to say that the population of detained people in the state of Minnesota in jails waiting to have their cases heard and waiting to actually go to court to be tried for these crimes for which they've been charged, is it accurate to say that the population of detained people has grown to a point that our jails are significantly over capacity?
Mr. Ward.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, I feel that jail administration for the counties would have to answer that question, could better answer it for you. They have been, yes. It depends on the county, obviously. Ultimately, as the members know, when jails get full, they then loan or borrow beds from other jails and other facilities. So some jails in construction are made larger so they can rent out bed space, for lack of a better term. There are substantial issues throughout the state as far as pretrial holding of people. And in fact, in northeastern Minnesota, there's many times we have to go to Superior, Wisconsin to see our clients because the jails are too full.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ward. You know, I just want to say that I think we really need to take a serious look in the state of Minnesota, well, and actually nationally, at this epidemic of folks who just happen to not have a whole lot of cash being stuck in our criminal justice system disproportionately to individuals with means and resources. And so, Representative Knorr, I want to thank you again for bringing this bill before our committee. I think it's an important bill, and I think it's an important step forward for our state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just wanted to, just a point of clarification to Mr. Ward. I think you said earlier when you were testifying it's $135 a day to house somebody in jail. Was that what I heard you say?
Madam Chair, that's on average. I mean, okay. Some places it costs more, but the average daily cost, I believe, in Hennepin County is over $135 a day, yes.
Okay. Thank you. It looks like we still have several questions. We are just about at time, so I could ask the members with questions to try to keep it short. And Representative Hassan.
I'll skip my question.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine's not so much a question. I believe at the last hearing, though, somebody said, well, this doesn't happen in greater Minnesota. I worked in a jail for over 21 years. I saw it happen thousands of times where somebody would go to court, come back, and tell me they had a $100 bail, and I'd go, great, let's go call somebody. I don't have anybody I can call. And, yeah, it was heartbreaking because, they'd gone to what was minimum bail, and they were going to lose their job, or they knew that they would be into a dispute on custody. This is something we really need to do and move forward. Thank you, Representative Knorr, for bringing it forward.
Representative Herr.
Yeah, just a really quick question. So thank you, Representative Knorr, for bringing this bill forward. My question is that, there is scholarly research that speaks to disparities in bail set for black and brown people for the same offenses committed by their white counterparts. Can you tell me if this bill impacts this issue at all?
Representative Knorr, Mr. Ward.
Madam Chair, I'm not representative. I'm not an expert on it. It should, right? I mean, the vast majority of cases that are charged out in Minnesota are misdemeanor cases. I can't speak to domestic cases and the exclusion of certain charges that are part of this bill. But obviously, and you're absolutely correct, I think the amount of about race and bail, it's on average 35% higher for African-American men and 19% higher for Hispanic men. So ultimately, this should have some impact. I couldn't tell you specifically how much.
Representative Herr?
Thank you.
All right. And one thing we didn't do yet is there anybody from the audience who wished to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, any final comments, Representative Knorr?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's okay. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is there any assurance in this bill that people are going to show up for their court date? I guess that would be a question for the author.
Representative Knorr?
Madam Chair, members, going through this process, I found out there's no evidence whatsoever that somebody by paying that cash bail assures the system that they'll be coming back. But what I can assure you is by giving those individuals the opportunity to really understand this is a time that they need to reflect and be able to present themselves to the court, this is an incentive for them. And we also put the conditions. If someone is failing to show up, the judge can put those conditions. We're not taking away the initiative to put those conditions, but this, what I know of, creates an opportunity for someone to come back to the court.
Madam Chair, if I may also, there's a study that just came out in Philadelphia There's a new district attorney there. He's been in there for 1 year, and he, as a policy, made a change somewhat similar to Representative Norris' bill. The study just came out. There was literally no change in failure to appear rates. In fact, the appearance rate was better than what people had anticipated. So the data is actually very positive. It's not negative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. At this point, I will move that House File 741 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. House File 741 is recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. At this point, members, our next meeting is Wednesday, February 27th. We have a busy agenda that day, and if we're unable to complete it, we'll carry it over to Thursday, February 28th. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.